This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening, and welcome to the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. I'm Ben Marcus, and I'm honored to be introducing tonight's guest, Lydia Davis. Ms. Davis is the author of four collections of short stories, a novel, and several highly lauded translations of literature into English, including Flaubert's Madame Bovary and the first volume of Proust's In Search of Lost Time, Swan's Way. In 2009, FSG published the collected stories of Lydia Davis, which runs to nearly 800 pages. For me, this length was hardly an obstacle. I tore through the book, encountering some of the stories for the fifth or sixth time because I've read her obsessively for over 20 years now. And when I finished, breathless and deranged with admiration and envy, I was more convinced than ever of Lydia Davis's standing as a major American writer. Among her staggering list of awards and prizes are fellowships from the MacArthur Foundation, a Whiting Writers Award, a Guggenheim, and the prestigious Chevalier of the Order of Arts and Letters issued by the French government. I could stand here most of the evening and recite more accolades to you, testimony from the most respected critics, writers, and readers that Lydia Davis writes with unmatched genius. But this won't fully reveal what it's like to read her, to enter the rigorous, playful, brainy, transfixing, and achingly sorrowful world of her fiction. The first thing to say is that so much of Lydia Davis's fiction does not seem like fiction. It seems, I'm not sure of the best word, true, matter of fact, or better yet, it does not seem made up, fancifully invented so that readers might escape into a land of make-believe. There's no once upon a time here. Rarely does one find in Miss Davis's fiction the dressing and artifice that decorates so much contemporary fiction. We're not asked as readers to suspend disbelief because somehow belief is a currency that comes readily in Lydia Davis's work, belief and truth and authority. These sound like the attributes not of fiction but of essays, nonfiction, philosophy. But if there's sometimes a cold, clear logic in her stories, which are often composed in the crisp language of analysis and reasoned out with technical precision, there is beneath this fiercely rigorous language a warm, pulsing narrator striving to be understood, to be felt, to be known. In other words, a human being is speaking to us this way, blood flowing under the ideas in the work. When I read Lydia Davis, I feel, wrongly, I imagine, that I know her intimately because her fiction arises in such a personal voice, plain spoken and clear rather than literary and adorned. It would seem that a friend is speaking to me, except friends, mine anyway, keep secrets, hold things back, censor themselves, grow embarrassed or ashamed when their thoughts are not flattering or pretty or pleasant. Not so the narrators in Lydia Davis's fiction, who would seem to gossip not of others but of the inner workings of their own minds. Gossip is the wrong word. It might give the wrong idea, but I use it to suggest how personal and revealing these voices are, how as readers we feel confided to, entrusted with something private, let in on a conspiracy. Maybe surveillance is the better word, except directed inward. An espionage of the self. Emerson observes that in the genius of others, we observe our own discarded thoughts, and it is Lydia Davis's genius to expand or simply not observe the typical fence lines of fiction, finding stories where no one had thought to look, to dive down into a territory too little noticed and reported on by other writers, and then once there, to behave fearlessly and document all that she sees and hears. We're given full uncensored access to a mind that notices everything. This mind worries and wonders, it doubles back, it second guesses. It is appropriate and inappropriate, obsessed with manners and details and ideas and feelings. It is relentless, as if Miss Davis had discovered a technology to listen in with pure accuracy on her thoughts, while the rest of us writers are tapping too gently with chisels on the surface of the head, barely drawing blood. This is original, brave, compelling fiction, and it's as thrilling as, well, any thriller I can think of, because it is fearless, because it is lucid, because it is generated by an exacting literary mind. The writers who hover behind Lydia Davis are W.G. Sebald, Thomas Bernhard, Jane Bowles, and of course Samuel Beckett. But none of these antecedents tell the whole story, or account really for the unique original body of work Lydia Davis has produced. She's a storyteller disguised as a philosopher, but even that equation seems off the mark. Perhaps then that is the key. The difficulty in naming her, assigning her an easy category, is just further proof that no one writes like Lydia Davis, not even close, which makes it all the more our great fortune to hear her work tonight, a true and original literary voice. And I ask you now to please join me in welcoming the very great Lydia Davis.
Thanks, Ben. That was very nice. And I'm very pleased to be back here at what's it called? Lensic? and Santa Fe and the Lannan Foundation. This reading is dedicated to Bill Cranshaw and the memory of Bill Cranshaw. I'm going to read mostly new work, but I'll start with one from the collected stories. But I generally like to read more recent work. Of course, I've been reading this new work, for a few years, so it's not that new anymore. But it's still relatively new, and some is brand new, just worked on the way here. So this feels like a cup game or a bean game here. Let's see if I can drink all of them in the course of the reading. So the first that's from the collected stories is called Jane and the Cane. Mother could not find her cane. She had a cane, but she could not find her special cane. Her special cane had a handle that was the head of a dog. Then she remembered Jane had her cane. Jane had come to visit. Jane had needed a cane to get back home. That was 2 years ago. Mother called Jane. She told Jane she needed her cane. Jane came with a cane. When Jane came, Mother was tired. She was in bed. She did not look at the cane. Jane went back home. Mother got out of bed. She looked at the cane. She saw that it was not the same cane. It was a plain cane. She called Jane and told her it was not the same cane. But Jane was tired. She was too tired to talk. She was going to bed. The next morning she came with the cane. Mother got out of bed. She looked at the cane. It was the right cane. It had the head of a dog on it, brown and white. Jane went home with the other cane, the plain cane. After Jane was gone, Mother complained. She complained on the phone. Why did Jane not bring back the cane? Why did Jane bring the wrong cane? Mother was tired. Oh, Mother was so tired of Jane and the cane. I think I was influenced by the readers, the first grade readers, which I actually found delightful. I'm going to read a few travel stories. Waiting for takeoff. We sit in the airplane so long on the ground waiting to take off that one woman declares she will now write her novel. And another in a neighboring seat says she will be happy to edit it. Food is being sold in the aisle, and the passengers, either hungry from waiting or worried that they will not see food again for some time, are eagerly buying it, even food they would not normally eat. For instance, there are candy bars long enough to use as weapons. The steward who is selling the food says he was once attacked by a passenger, though not with a candy bar. Because the plane had been delayed so long, he said, the passenger threw a drink in his face, damaging one eyeball with a piece of ice. The woman next to me on the airplane. The woman next to me has many fast and easy crossword puzzles to do during the flight, from a book called Fast and Easy Crosswords. I have only slow and difficult crosswords, or impossible crosswords. She finishes each puzzle and turns the page as we fly at top speed through the air. I stare at one page and don't finish any. The Bad Novel. This dull, difficult novel I have brought with me on my trip, I keep trying to read it. I have gone back to it so many times, each time dreading it and each time finding it no better than the last time, that by now it has become something of an old friend, my old friend, the bad novel. Two undertakers. One undertaker, taking a body north on the highway in France, stops at a roadside restaurant for a bite of lunch. There he meets another undertaker, a colleague known to him, who has also stopped for a bite of lunch and who is taking a body south. They decide to sit at the same table and have their meal together. This encounter of two professionals is witnessed by Roland Barthes. It is his own deceased mother who is being taken south. He watches from a separate table where he sits with his sister. His mother, of course, lies outside in the hearse. On the train. We are united, he and I, though strangers, against the two women in front of us talking so steadily and audibly across the aisle to each other. Bad manners. We shrug, frown, and glower. Later in the journey, I look over at him across the aisle, and he is picking his nose. As for me, I am dripping tomato from my sandwich onto my newspaper. Bad habits. I would not report this if I were the one picking my nose. I look again, and he is still at it. As for the women, they are now sitting together side by side and quietly reading, clean and tidy, one a magazine, one a book. Blameless. The next thing I'm going to read is a set of little stories that were made from dreams. For a while, I got very interested in how to shape a story, how to shape a dream into a story that would have some coherence and wouldn't be boring the way dreams usually are. So it involved cutting and shaping a little bit and writing it in a particular style. And then I broadened the category to include events in my actual life and even events in friends' lives that seemed like dreams to me, and that could be shaped to sound like dreams. So these are mixed. Some are friends' experiences, some mine, and some real dreams. Awake in the night. I can't go to sleep in this hotel room in this strange city. It is very late, 2 in the morning, then 3, then 4. I am lying in the dark. What is the problem? Oh, maybe I am missing him, the person I sleep next to. Then I hear a door shut somewhere nearby. Another guest has come in very late. Now I have the answer. I will go to this person's room and get in bed with him. Then I will be able to sleep. The Sentence and the Young Man. A sentence lies exposed to public view in an open trash can. It is the ungrammatical sentence, "Who sing?" We are watching it from where we stand concealed, perhaps in a shadowed archway. We see a young man walk past the trash can several times, eyeing the sentence curiously. We will stay where we are for fear that at any moment he will reach in quickly and fix it. Dinner. I'm still in bed when friends of ours arrive at the house for dinner. My bed is in the kitchen. I get up to see what I can make for them. I find 3 or 4 packages of hamburger in the refrigerator, some partly used and some untouched. I think I can put all of the hamburger together and make a meatloaf. This would take an hour, but nothing else occurs to me. I go back to bed for a while to think about it. The grandmother. A man has come to my house carrying a very large peach tart. He has also brought with him some other people, including a very old woman who complains about the gravel and is then carried into the house with great difficulty. At the table, the old woman observes to one man by way of conversation that she likes his teeth. Another man keeps shouting in her face, but she is not frightened. She only looks at him balefully. Later, when she is back at home, it is discovered that while she has been eating many cashews from a bowl, she has also eaten her hearing aid. Even though she chewed on it for nearly 2 hours, she could not reduce it to particles small enough to swallow. At bedtime, she spat it out into the hand of her caregiver and told him this nut was a bad one. The piano. We are about to buy a new piano. Our old upright has a crack all the way through its sounding board and other problems. We would like the piano shop to take it and resell it, but they tell us it is too badly damaged and cannot be resold to anyone else. They say it will have to be pushed over a cliff. This is how they will do it. 2 truck drivers take it to a remote spot with a high elevation. One turns his back and walks away down the lane, while the other shoves it over the cliff. At the bank, one. I take my bag of pennies to the bank and throw them into a machine that will count them. I am asked by a functionary to guess how much my pennies are worth. I guess $3. I am wrong. They amount to $4.24. But since I am within $1.99 of the correct sum, I qualify for a prize. Many people nearby in the bank congratulate me warmly. I may choose from among a number of prizes. When I refuse the first and the second, and seem likely to refuse the next, the anxious teller unlocks a secure vault and shows me the full array, which includes a large plastic piggy bank, a coloring book, and crayons, and a small rubber ball. At last, so as not to disappoint her, I choose what I think is the best of them, a handsome frisbee with its own carrying case. At the bank, too. Again, I go to the bank with a bag full of pennies. Again, I guess that my pennies will add up to $3. The machine counts them. I have $4.92. Again, the bank officer says I am close enough to the correct amount to win a prize. I look forward to seeing what the selection of prizes will be this time, but there is only one prize, a tape measure. I am disappointed, but I accept it. At least this time I can tell that the bank officer is a woman. Each time before, there was no way to tell if she was a woman or a man. But this time, though she is still bald, her motions are less mechanical, her voice is higher, she smiles, and there is a pin on her chest that says, Janet. Next, I'm going to read a few stories from about 13 that I've done up to now that I'm calling 10 stories from Flaubert. Well, I'm calling them 13 stories from Flaubert, I guess. I just added 3 recently. While I was translating Madame Bovary, I read some part of the correspondence of Flaubert, that the part that covered the period when he was writing the novel, hoping to learn something about his style and also his thoughts about writing the novel. But along the way, I kept coming across these little stories that he would tell his correspondent, and I found them very charming and very complete, although he never would have considered them complete stories. And I decided to try to rescue them as stories, so I extracted them from the letters and did as little as I could to change them. I tried to preserve them as much as possible in his words, but I did shape them a bit. I cut here and there. I combined sometimes a few of his... Once I combined two different stories. Most of them are very short. So I'll read about five of them. The first is called The Cook's Lesson. Today I have learned a great lesson. Our cook was my teacher. She is 25 years old and she's French. I discovered that she does not know that Louis-Philippe is no longer king of France, and we now have a republic. And yet it has been 5 years since he left the throne. She said the fact that he is no longer king simply does not interest her in the least. Those were her words. And I think of myself as an intelligent man, but compared to her, I'm an imbecile. The visit to the dentist. Last week I went to the dentist thinking he was going to pull my tooth. He said it would be better to wait and see if the pain subsided. Well, the pain did not subside. I was in agony and running a fever. So yesterday I went to have it pulled. On my way to see him, I had to cross the old marketplace where they used to execute people not so long ago. I remembered that when I was only 5 or 6 or 7 years old, returning home from school one day, I crossed the square after an execution had taken place. The guillotine was there. I saw fresh blood on the paving stones. They were carrying away the basket. Last night I thought about how I had entered the square on my way to the dentist, dreading what was about to happen to me, and how, in the same way, those people condemned to death also used to enter that square, dreading what was about to happen to them, though it was worse for them. When I fell asleep, I dreamed about the guillotine. The strange thing was that my little niece, who sleeps downstairs, also dreamed about a guillotine, though I hadn't said anything to her about it. I wonder if thoughts are fluid and flow downward from one person to another within the same house. The Coachman and the Worm. A former servant of ours, a pathetic fellow, is now the driver of a hackney cab. You'll probably remember how he married the daughter of that porter who was awarded a prestigious prize at the same time that his wife was being sentenced to penal servitude for theft, whereas he, the porter, was actually the thief. In any case, this unfortunate man, Tolle, our former servant, has, or thinks he has, a tapeworm inside him. He talks about it as though it were a living person who communicates with him and tells him what it wants. And when Tolle is talking to you, the word he always refers to this creature inside him. Sometimes Tolle has a sudden urge and attributes it to the tapeworm. He wants it, he says. And right away, Tolle obeys. Lately, he wanted to eat some fresh white rolls. Another time, he had to have some white wine. Though the next day he was outraged because he wasn't given red. The poor man has by now lowered himself in his own eyes to the same level as the tapeworm. They are equals waging a fierce battle for dominance. He said to my sister-in-law lately, "That creature has it in for me. It's a battle of wills, you see. He's forcing me to do what he likes. But I'll have my revenge. Only one of us will be left alive." Well, the man is the one who will be left alive, or rather not for long, because in order to kill the worm and be rid of it, he recently swallowed a bottle of vitriol and is at this moment dying. What a strange thing it is, the human brain. The chairs. Louis has been in the church in Mont looking at the chairs. He has been looking at them very closely. He wants to learn as much as he can about the people from looking at their chairs, he says. He started with the chair of a woman he calls Madame Fricotte. Maybe her name was written on the back of the chair. She must be very stout, he says. The seat of the chair has a deep hollow in it, and the prayer stool has been reinforced in a couple of places. Her husband may be a rich man because the prayer stool is upholstered in red velvet with brass tacks. Or he thinks the woman may be a widow because there is no chair belonging to Monsieur Fricotte, unless he's an atheist. In fact, perhaps Madame Fricotte, if she is a widow, is looking for another husband, since the back of her chair is heavily stained with hair dye. I wrote a genuine letter of complaint quite a few years ago to a funeral parlor because of their use of the word cremains. And the more I worked on this letter, the less it seemed sendable. It kind of took off in a different direction and became a little bit mannered and just didn't seem like a real letter anymore, so I never sent it. And instead, it's in the collected stories. But then I modified it and did send it to them. I never heard back from them. But it gave me the idea of a whole new fertile territory because I'm a person who does complain quite a bit and finds a lot to complain about, even when I don't complain. So I wrote a few more letters of complaint, some of which I sent, or maybe I sent all of them, and got different reactions, usually completely irrelevant to my complaint. But I'll read two of them, one quite short and one quite long. Letter to a frozen peas manufacturer. Dear frozen peas manufacturer, we are writing to you because we feel that the peas illustrated on your package of frozen peas are a most unattractive color. We are referring to the 16-ounce plastic package that shows three or four pods, one of them split open, with peas rolling out near them. The peas are a dull yellow-green, more the color of pea soup than fresh peas, and nothing like the actual color of your peas, which are a nice, bright, dark green. The depicted peas are, moreover, about three times the size of the actual peas inside the package, which, together with their dull color, makes them even less appealing. They appear to be past their maturity and mealy in texture. Additionally, the color of your illustrated peas contrasts poorly with the color of the lettering and other decoration on your package, which is an almost harsh neon green. We have compared your depiction of peas to that of other frozen peas packages, and yours is by far the least appealing. Most food manufacturers depict food on their packaging that is more attractive than the food inside, and therefore deceptive. You are doing the opposite. You are falsely representing your peas as less attractive than they actually are. We enjoy your peas and do not want your business to suffer. Please reconsider your art. Yours sincerely. Letter to a hotel manager. Dear hotel manager, I am writing to point out to you that the word scrod has been misspelled on your restaurant menu, so that it appears as shrod with an SCH. This word was very puzzling to me when I first read it, dining alone on the first night of my two-night stay at your hotel, in your restaurant on the ground floor, off your very beautiful lobby with its carved wood panels, lofty ceiling, and rank of gold elevators. I thought this spelling must be right and I must be wrong, since here I was in New England, in Boston, in fact, home of the cod and the scrod. But when I came down from my room to the lobby the following night, about to dine in your restaurant for the second time, this time with my older brother, and as I waited there in the lobby for him, which is something I generally like to do if the setting is a pleasant one and I'm looking forward to a good dinner, though in fact on this occasion I was quite early and my brother was quite late, so that the wait became rather long and I began to wonder if something had happened to my brother, I was reading some literature provided to me by the friendly clerk behind the reception desk, whose manner, like that of the other staff, with the exception perhaps of the restaurant manager, was so natural and unaffected that my stay in your hotel was greatly enhanced by it, after I asked if he had any account of the history of your hotel, since so many interesting and famous people have stayed here or worked here or eaten or drunk here, including my own great-great-grandmother, though she was not famous. And in this literature, presumably written by the hotel, I read that your restaurant claimed, in fact, to have invented the word scrod to describe the catch of the day, in contrast to cod, I suppose, for which this city is also famous. I also remembered, perhaps wrongly, seeing this word elsewhere spelled shrod with an SH, unless that is a different word with a different meaning. I had thought, I suppose mistakenly, that scrod meant young cod, or perhaps it was shrod that meant young cod, and scrod that meant catch of the day, if the word shrod with an SH existed at all. I don't know much about scrod, only the old joke about the two genteel ladies returning on the train from Boston and in the course of their conversation mistaking the word scrod for a past tense. And I had always thought it was a particular kind of fish. For a moment the previous evening, as I say, I thought this spelling might even be correct, and then I was fairly certain it was not correct, but I was unsure whether it should be shrod with an SH or scrod if the word shrod existed. But nowhere else have I seen it spelled shrod with an SCH. I did eventually on the second evening make a connection, perhaps a false one, between this misspelling and the accent with which your restaurant manager addressed my brother and me. This manager was present in the dining room both nights I ate there, and although courteous, seemed a bit cool in his manner, not to me in particular, but to everyone, and on the second evening did not seem to want to prolong the conversation I started with him, in which I suggested that the restaurant might add baked beans to the menu, since baked beans are also native to Boston, and the restaurant boasts of being the inventor of Boston cream pie, the official Massachusetts state dessert, as I learned from the hotel literature, as well as the Parker House roll. He seemed almost transparently impatient to end the conversation and move on, though move on to what, I did not know, since he did not appear to have more of a function than to walk rather self-importantly, by which I mean with an excessively erect posture, from one end of the long, rather dim, splendid room to the other. That is, from the wide doorway through which a handful of people now and then came in from the lobby to have dinner, to what must have been the kitchen, well hidden behind some sort of bar and two large potted palms. In any case, I noticed as he stood conversing with us, inclined slightly toward us, but at each pause turning to move away, that his accent might be identified as German. And this caused me later, when I was thinking about the misspelling of scrod, to speculate that the very Germanic SCH spelling was his doing. This may be quite unfair, and perhaps it was someone else, someone younger, who misspelled scrod, and the mistake was not caught by your manager because of his Germanic predisposition towards beginning a word with SCH. Here I should add in his defense, parenthetically, that despite his cool manner, he seemed quite open to my idea that baked beans might be included on the menu. He explained that at one time the restaurant had brought out little pots of baked beans with the rolls and butter at the start of the meal, and that they had stopped doing this because so many other restaurants in Boston featured baked beans. I did not want him to think I liked the idea of the little pots at the start of the meal. Far from it. I thought it was a terrible idea. Baked beans at the start of the meal would not be a good appetizer, being so heavy and sweet. No, no, I said, they should simply be listed somewhere on the menu. I happen to love baked beans, and I had been disappointed not to find them here in this Boston restaurant, along with the scrod, the Parker House rolls, and the Boston cream pie, all of which I ordered on the second night. My dinner companion, that is my brother, was tolerant of this protracted and perhaps pointless conversation, either because he was happy enough to be sitting over a nice dinner and a glass of red wine after the difficult day he had had, going here and there in the city, which is not his native city, as he attempted to complete several pieces of business in connection with our mother's estate, not all of which were successful, or else because my behavior reminded him, in fact, of our mother, who was so very likely to start a conversation with a stranger, or rather, it would be more truthful to say, could hardly let a stranger come anywhere near her without striking up a conversation with him, learning something about his life and letting him know about some firmly held conviction of hers, and who passed away last fall, much to our regret. Although, naturally enough, certain of her habits bothered us while she was alive, we like to be reminded of her now because we miss her, and we are probably both adopting some of those very habits if we had not already adopted them long ago. I think my brother even added a suggestion of his own to the manager after sitting listening quietly to mine. This was actually the second time, now at the urging of our waiter, who thought my idea was a good one, that I had called the manager over to our table. The first time I waved to him, it was not to speak to him about the baked beans or the spelling of scrod, but about another guest in the nearly empty dining room, a very poised little old woman, her hair in a pearl-gray bun at the nape of her neck, who sat surprisingly low down on the banquette by the side of her much younger hired companion, so that she had to reach quite far up and out to find her food. I had noticed her during my dinner the night before, since we were near one another and there were even fewer guests, and the companion and I had at last struck up a conversation during which I learned that the old woman lived a short walk away and had been having her dinner at the hotel every night for many years, and that in fact I was inadvertently occupying her usual spot in the dining room under the brightest light. The companion, after consulting the old woman, had specified that she had been coming here for 30 years, which astounded me. But now, on the second night, the restaurant manager corrected this to a mere 5 or 6. I wanted to suggest, perhaps because I had drunk my glass of Côte du Rhône by then and was feeling inspired, that the hotel should make a photographic portrait of her and hang it on the wall in one of the rooms, since she was now part of the history of the hotel. I still think that would be a good idea, and that you might consider it. In fact, later I got up from my chair, perhaps indiscreetly, and went over to the old woman and her companion as they were leaving, and suggested the same thing, to their obvious pleasure. I did not think it would be tactful, however, to bring up the spelling of scrod so directly with the manager, and that is why I am instead now mentioning it in a letter to you. My stay in your grand hotel was delightful, and apart from perhaps the coolness of the restaurant manager, every aspect of the service and presentation was flawless except for this one spelling mistake. I do believe the purported home of the scrod should be a place where it is spelled correctly. Thank you for your attention. Yours sincerely. The next The next is a lot shorter and more fragmented. It's more or less a list. It's called How I Read as Quickly as Possible Through My Back Issues of the TLS. I don't know if you know the TLS, the Times Literary Supplement, all of you, but it's my favorite reading material, and it's so inspiring. It has so many different reviews in it about so many different things, and it comes out every week, that I get very far behind because I tend to read it, mark it, take notes from it, clip it, file it, before I actually throw the remainder of it away. So I have bags and bags of this journal at home that I haven't yet read. So every now and then I try to go through them very quickly, but it's not easy. And this is only a beginning of what it will eventually be, I suppose. How I Read as Quickly as Possible Through My Back Issues of the TLS. I do not want to read about the life of Jerry Lewis. I do want to read about mammalian carnivores. I do not want to read about the portrait of a castrato. I do want to read about the history of the Inca Quipu. I do not want to read about the history of the panda in China, A Dictionary of Women in Shakespeare. I do not want to read about Ronald Reagan. I do want to read about sow bugs. I want to read about the creation of the musical South Pacific, which they say will contribute greatly to the still underwritten history of the Broadway musical. Not interested in the Oxford Companion to Canadian Military History. Not interested today in Hitler or London theater productions. Interested in the psychology of lying, Anne Carson's book about the death of her brother, French writers admired by Proust, Catullus, translation. Not interested in the creation of the Statue of Liberty. Interested in beer, East Prussia after World War II, Philo-Semitism. Not interested in the Archbishop of Canterbury. Not interested in this poem, Light Dazzles from the Grass Over the Carnal Dune. Not interested in any of these poems, or the Anglo-Portuguese establishment, or heraldic leopards. Interested in dust jackets in the history of bibliography. Interested in the life of Borges and the life of Raymond Queneau. Not interested in the friendship of Elgar and Shanker, or the Audit Commission, or any of this fiction, or the work of Alexander Pope. Interested in altruism, the Pont Neuf, the history of daguerreotypes. Not interested in a cultural history of the British census. Not interested in, or well, yes, maybe interested in, the history of diplomacy, Laura Bush's autobiography. I'll read a few just new short ones and then end with the very, very short ones. This is called Circular Story. On Wednesday mornings early, there is always a racket out there on the road. It always wakes me up. I always wonder what it is. It is always the trash collection truck picking up the trash. It comes every Wednesday morning early. It always wakes me up. I always wonder what it is. Susie Brown will be in town. Susie Brown will be in town. She will be in town to sell her things. Susie Brown is moving far away. She would like to sell her queen mattress. Do we want her queen mattress? Do we want her ottoman? Do we want her bath items? It is time to say goodbye to Susie Brown. We have enjoyed her friendship. We have enjoyed her tennis lessons. The dog hair. The dog is gone. We miss him. When the doorbell rings, no one barks. When we come home late, no one is waiting for us. We still find his white hairs here and there around the house and on our clothes. We pick them up. We should throw them away, but they are all we have left of him. We don't throw them away. We have a wild hope. If only we collect enough of them, we will be able to put the dog back together again. Two former students. One former student told the other former student to go away out there in the snow at night. Go away, he said to the other. If she sees us both, she will label us both former students, forgetting that I am I and you are you. He was the older former student. He had fought in a war. He had not reenlisted because he wanted to do something else with his life. He was deaf in one ear. The other former student was young, but he had been to Europe. It was true that as she looked out the window at them walking back and forth under the streetlight, they were, in her mind, two former students, more so than if each of them had been alone, fully himself, though also unavoidably a former student. The last group are the very shortest, and they came about when I was translating Proust. I didn't have much time to write my own things, for one thing. I had to pretty much work all day on the Proust. And for another, I was translating such long sentences often. Not all of Proust's sentences are long, but some of them are immensely long with many subordinate clauses and very complex structures. And I think in reaction to that, I set myself the problem of writing the very shortest thing I possibly could. And in some cases, just a title and a line or two, in which case, of course, the title becomes important, even more important than usual. So that's what I did, and I haven't lost the habit of it. Some things just seem to want to be no more than that long. So I'll read a few of those. Sitting with my little friend. Sitting with my little friend in the sunshine on the front step. I am reading a book by Blanchot, and she is licking her leg. Notes during a long phone conversation with mother. For summer, she needs pretty dress, cotton, natok, kunt, takunt, tunkt, tuknot, takant, tukton, kantat. Can't and won't. I was recently denied a writing prize because they said I was lazy. What they meant by lazy was that I used too many contractions. For instance, I would not write out in full the words cannot and will not, but instead contracted them to can't and won't. Short conversation in airport departure lounge. Is that a new sweater? One woman asks another, a stranger sitting next to her. The stranger says it's not. There is no further conversation. Contingency versus necessity. He could be our dog, but he is not our dog. So he barks at us. Judgment. Into how small a space the word judgment can be compressed. It must fit inside the brain of a ladybug as she, before my eyes, makes a decision. The language of the telephone company. The trouble you reported recently is now working properly. Bloomington. Now that I have been here for a little while, I can say with confidence that I have never been here before. Housekeeping observation. Under all this dirt, the floor is really very clean. PhD. All these years, I thought I had a PhD, but I do not have a PhD. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Lydia, thank you for your reading. Could we go back to the beginning for you when you were first seriously writing fiction? And could we have a picture of your mind and what you saw when you looked out at the world of literature and what your desires were? And have they changed quite a bit? But I guess your writing is, it's so exceptionally unique. It really seems to carry its own very strong fingerprint. And I would love to see if we could suss out some kind of source connected to your first desires when you were first writing.
Yeah, well, I suppose I can try. It would be a long story, so I won't go into as much detail as I could, but I guess I emulated certain writers. I want to go back even further. Let's see, when I was 7 years old. No, I never thought of being anything but a short story writer, although I wrote poetry and read poetry. I emulated writers like Kafka and Beckett. I didn't read a lot of contemporary fiction. That's what I realized later, except for my friend's work, strangely. I mean, we would read each other's work. But I would read someone like Beckett and really study how he put his sentences together. Mm-hmm. And how do you do that, you know, and how could I do it? And there was a very intensive group, really, of writers among my friends. And we would read each other's work terribly seriously. I mean, I've recently found letters where, you know, a friend would go over a story and say, I think it would be stronger if you took this out and change this. You know, I mean,
was this group, were you looking out at the, let's say, the world of mainstream fiction or whatever the bigger, supposedly big, important novels were of that time? Was this
on
your radar?
No, I didn't look at those big, important novels. I didn't look at mainstream fiction. I didn't look at our contemporaries. I don't know why, but somewhere I got the idea that, okay, you study the great masters.
Right.
And you don't study X and Y that just came out last year. So I just didn't for years and years and years. And, you know, it's a little hard to understand now because young writers now do read, you know, work that's come out recently. So I don't know.
Okay. And was this, let's say, the essayistic mode, the quizzical, analytic mode, was it there from the start for you when you assembled your collected stories and you looked at those earliest stories? Did you have any urge to return to them, to play with them, to...
And that's about six questions at once.
is four.
Four questions, okay. Because I thought of something else to say about the first one. See if I can keep all this in my head. That if you don't read what's being written around you, then you'll form your own reaction, a more individual reaction maybe, to someone like Beckett or Kafka, and yet you're not ever divorced from your time, so you're always absorbing the spirit of
your
time.
You'll write of your time no matter what.
Yeah,
you don't need
no matter what, even if you lived in a cabin in Wyoming.
Do you still not read contemporary fiction?
Oh, no. Now I do.
Now you do.
No, I did start reading it after a few years. But then to go to the next question, which was your next question?
Well, I was wondering if the seeds of this philosophical
mode were
there, and was it very conscious for you?
No, I mean, I think I was that kind of person. I mean, I think what you are now at my age, you also were at age 7, more or less, and 12 and 16. So I was the same person, but I started out with more conservative set ideas, which I think young people do. You'd think young people would be more radical, but they're not. They're more conservative. Okay, this is what a short story should be, and this is how to write it, and this is how I will write it. Because I teach fiction writing, so, and every term it's a different set of students with a different set of problems, but one thing I'm realizing is that you'll have a very good writer who hasn't broken through yet so that she or he can, so let's say she to make it easier, so that her fiction will express her whole character and her whole nature with all its idiosyncrasies. That only happens at a certain moment. And
what do you tell her in order for her to accomplish that?
Well, I just realized this recently that... And I'm not sure it would work to say, let your whole being go forth into your fiction.
Yes.
Although I think it might help to say that. But so many work under constraints, and you can see their language isn't... I mean, I had one student, I should have realized this years ago, he always wrote with a very old-fashioned sort of white male bias and putting down females. And yet whenever I talked to him, he wasn't that way at all. And then I realized I made a connection between him and some of his unfortunate mentors.
Ah.
And then he was carrying their attitudes into his fiction and not carrying his own whole being into his fiction.
Do you find these things to be addressable with students? And we're on tangent number two, but I'm just curious if when you can diagnose this problem, and I teach as well, and sometimes you see one can see this, but is there a way out of this? And I guess since I like to add questions, did someone do this for you?
No. Well, okay, that is a few interesting questions. I think you can keep hammering away at students. I think they're very reluctant. I mean, I've had just this last term, you know, very bright, good writer who said very timidly, do you think I could present the class with a series of very short stories, or do you think I should write, you know, show them one long one? As if she didn't have permission to do whatever she wanted. And I really think it's very hard for them to break through that. So I think it's a matter of me saying over and over again, this doesn't sound like you, or, you know, so on. But then, what was your last one? Oh,
did you have a teacher who pushed you along
I had only one fiction workshop or two. I recently discovered there was one in college, which I completely forgot about. But then
how did you discover that? You were looking over the old
archival transcript.
Oh,
and
I see.
My transcript was nothing to boast about.
So you completely forgot this course.
I completely forgot it. So I thought that I had no writing workshop. They certainly didn't have a writing major, but they did have a writing. It may not have been a workshop, but a class, you know. And then I did have a class with Grace Paley, a workshop with Grace Paley. If you have to have one workshop,
sure,
that would be great, except that I remember nothing of what she said. I think she said very little. She was a very modest, quiet person, so I remember nothing of what she said. Only one boy who was very talkative and boring. I remember him better than Grace Paley. But it was the work of a writer that...
I think we're issuing quite an endorsement for creative writing education tonight.
I'm finally coming down in favor of it. Usually I come down not in favor of it, but I think I actually am coming down in favor with certain cautions. But a writer did that for me, and maybe that's the way it happens. You don't have someone saying, well, you know, these are good and they're workmanlike, yeah, and they're well written, but they don't have all of your character in them. But I read the short stories of Russell Edson, and some people usually do know his work. He calls himself a poet, but his pieces are really, they're in prose and they're narrative and they're strange.
Yeah, he calls them fables sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. I guess. But they were so bizarre. And then importantly, they didn't all work. Some of them sort of fell flat.
He tries harder for humor than you do. And what's so extraordinary about your work is how completely deadpan it is. And the humor partly arises because there's no admission of it. The voice seems immune to it, which that just seems to make it funnier. Maybe we can switch topics a little bit, and I'll try to stick to single questions, but, well, no, I won't. I won't. This is a multi-parter. But I'd love to hear, I know I sense your stories are very intuitive, that they arise through great spectral forces that I can only be jealous of, but when there is some material on the page and perhaps the work becomes a little more concrete or a little more conscious, can you talk a little bit about how you edit yourself? How a very short piece comes into being? Is it longer ever? Do you winnow? Are there conscious standards you apply, or does it remain really intuitive until there's a final draft? That's six questions.
Well, it is always intuitive, if by that you mean that I don't plan ahead. And I don't, every time I say something, I realize I can contradict it, sort of, you know, with the Flaubert. I mean, the light went on when I said, oh, these could be stories. And then I said, I'm going to do a set of stories. So in that sense, I was planning ahead. But if, say the little tiny one that I read toward the end about the woman asking the stranger in the airport lounge if that was a new sweater. That was just something I wrote down in my notebook. And
did that really happen?
It happened. And it was bizarre. And I have a reflex of writing down everything that strikes me. And some of it just, a lot of it just I don't ever look at again. But then others I look back at and think, oh, well, maybe this is a whole thing rather than just...
Yeah.
And the one about the women, annoying women on the train in front of us and the stranger and I complaining about them. That I wrote on the train because at first, again, it was just a note in a notebook. One part of that all struck me, and then I thought, okay, I'm just going to write the whole thing out and then let it alone for a while. But then in some cases, I do winnow down from something longer, and the PhD one that I read, the very last one, actually started as one of the dream pieces, and it was the dream of a friend of mine who actually does have a PhD. And this is her anxiety dream that she has every year or so. She dreams that there was one crucial exam she never passed, and she doesn't have her PhD. So that was originally as long as a little paragraph, and then I realized it was better as just one single sentence.
And what you're saying suggests another question I had thought of, and it's a very uncanny sensation I have when I read you. Your work, although it's called fiction, feels sometimes quite autobiographical. But I have no real reason to think that, other than I think the tonality and the rhetoric of it is so. And I can think of so many first-person narrations in contemporary fiction that don't ever really occur to me as being autobiographical. And I'm interested in that, how that intimacy is achieved, because it seems to make the stories more powerful. The sense that there is I have a kind of an image of you that is, I think, entirely fictional as a sort of a character who has lived through all of these sometimes not very dramatic situations. Let's face it, it's not a lot of car crashes and international intrigue, espionage. And so there's this kind of ancillary effect of me picturing you as as the character behind this. Are these autobiographical stories? Do you think of them that way? Is your the mundane encounters of your life, is it a very regular resource to you? Do you switch away and invent things? Do you enjoy, this reaction that I have as your reader? I'm sure you've encountered this before.
Well, sort of the yes to all of your questions. In other words, a lot of it's autobiographical. Except that, say when I'm noting what this woman said to this other woman, I'm at a remove from myself and a remove from them. I'm just sort of this neutral, faceless observer. It doesn't matter who I am. And also, I feel very free to introduce a little fictional element. That's part of what makes it fun. If it doesn't work quite right, absolutely recording the reality, then I can change it, as I did with the Flaubert. You know, some of the stories needed a little something different, so I didn't add any fiction of my own to them, but I would add this from that other letter and put it in here, or do a little research or something. And then I go away from my life. I guess translating is a way for me to get completely out of my life and myself and my writing and inhabit someone else. Or presently I'm working on a long poem. It's 50, 60 pages by now, but it's all shaped from someone else's memoir, as sort of a privately printed memoir written in the 1870s. So there again, I contrast, you know, I go away from my own life to something completely different, as Monty Python always says.
It would seem, correct me if I'm wrong, that you've been translating perhaps about as long as you've been writing fiction. And so possibly you've tired of the question of how these practices speak to each other. But I would be curious to hear, in some sense, I have trouble even thinking of your fiction while not thinking of you as a kind of a technician of language, as someone fluent in other languages, someone who, for a living, inhabits the sentences of others. I feel that tactile control in your English language fiction. Do you, when you're translating, are you conscious of a kind of a gathering of techniques and tools and ideas, or do you feel there's a wall up between? I mean, certainly now you're writing some fiction based on some of your ancillary translation work. Do you have any thoughts about the relation of the two practices?
Well, they seem to be converging in a funny way. The Flaubert stories being a perfect example, but there I'm not separating my fiction from my translation at all, because I'm translating his material and shaping it to be what I can call my story, even though you know, half the credit goes to him, or, you know, or more than half. I'll have to figure that out. And then the same with this memoir that I'm shaping. So
it's funny, though. Those sound so much like your stories.
I know, and yet I...
don't think he should get any credit.
I didn't...
He's dead.
Most I know, it's, you know, he can't complain.
Need more accolade.
And yet I didn't really change, you know, much of the sentence structure. So maybe it's just what I found interesting sounds like me or something. I can't figure that one out. But
do you have plans for any more large translation projects like the Flaubert or the Proust?
No more books, because each of those last two books, Madame Bovary and the Proust, took 2 or 3 years probably of very painstaking work. The Proust was so painstaking, and then I thought I would never do that again, but the Flaubert was painstaking too. But now I've decided to branch out, and I've been doing these little tiny stories from the Dutch by a Dutch writer who hasn't been translated into English before, so it's kind of exciting. And
what's the writer's name?
A.L. Snijders.
Will there be
not at all spelled the way you would think Snijders should be spelled, of course,
since
it's Dutch. There's no S-C-H in it, but it's got a J in the middle of it, which doesn't belong there, of course. And he writes very... He was just suggested to me. I didn't look at a whole bunch of writers and choose him. But he writes from his own life, and they're just a page or less, and they're very plain and straightforward. And I think there's a little fictional fiddling here and there, but mostly not. So it's another good match.
One of my favorite books of yours is your novel, The End of the Story. It's intimate and searching. It's analytical. It's heartbreaking. The narrator is recounting in obsessive detail a relationship that was never particularly romantic to begin with. It's a wonderful book, and I wonder now, hearing some of your fiction is growing increasingly short, although you still sometimes return to longer pieces. Do you think about writing a novel again? Is it on your mind? Is it in your plans?
Now and then I would love to write just a straightforward novel, you know.
We all.
Even a detective novel. My mother wrote a detective novel that she never managed to get published. So
just sign your name to it.
No, that wouldn't work. But I have thought of, you know, trying to fix it and work with it. I've also long had a desire to write a novel that would be also a grammar book, a French grammar. And that's been a plan for really probably 20 years. And I couldn't figure out quite how to do it, but I kept going back to it, making outlines and which grammar would I teach in which chapter. It was going to be a murder mystery also. But I keep getting new projects that come along and push that to the back.
I think of you as someone who write these perfect sentences, and I think perhaps because of your translation work, I'm even more aware that every word is exactly as you want it to be. You don't strike me as a writer who sometimes kind of casts about wildly for the right way to phrase something and works through, let's say, different kinds of locution. You seem so controlled, and so I wonder, and maybe even hope, that there's something that, let's say, at the literary or technical rhetorical level, that still looks hard to you or daunting or like a technical challenge. I'm curious if there are things out there that look formidable to you and that you might like to tackle one day but feel you still need to learn.
Oh, other forms
I suppose, or modes or approaches or...
I probably don't even think about the ones that I mean, there are plenty of kinds of writing I absolutely couldn't do. And I probably, and now and then I see that, you know, as I'm reading them and think, I could never do that. Oh, well, why don't I tell you instead, since I can't quickly think of what they would be. Maybe it'll come to me. But what I do have trouble with, I see you perk up, is endings. I mean, sometimes I don't, but sometimes I do. And endings are very hard. You know, say I'll have the 2 pages, and the thing is only 2 pages long. And it's good right up to the end, but the last sentence or two are just weak, and I know that. And I can't make them better. And I just tend to sit on it and wait and, you know, come back to it weeks later or months later or
Do you have a sense of what you would like it to be, but just not the ability to make it happen, or you just are waiting for it to feel right?
I know it should end approximately there, but it's just and sometimes it's that I haven't completed the thought. I've got the thought this far, and I actually haven't completed the thought. And once I do complete it, then
it might be the content of the story more, let's say, than the delivery.
Well, I mean, sometimes I've done that trick, which, you know, there's a stronger sentence right before the last one, and I just switch them. But that's usually that doesn't work as easily as that. It did work in the poem, which I do consider a poem, the head heart.
Yeah.
That the next to the last line was the last line, and it was weaker, and I just was able to switch them and end with the stronger line. But usually it is content. But like the first one I read tonight, I think I didn't quite get the last line for a while. The last line is, "Oh, mother is so tired of Jane and the cane." And it that worked because we're all sort of tired of the thing by now, you know.
I never heard you read that. It was wonderful. Thank you for a terrific reading, and thank you all for listening. Thanks, too, to the Lannan Foundation.
Stage?
Yeah, you can join us in the lobby. We'll be signing books.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.